The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
We are only days away from the start of jury selection for Karen Reed's second trial. And the closer we get, the more things seem to get heated in the courtroom. Now, if you listened to last week's episode, you already know that the attorneys and the judge seem to be taking things a lot more personally this time around. And it seems like everyone is struggling to keep cool as these pretrial hearings are heating up. In the last episode, we left off with the hearing from March 20th, and there are a few more topics in that hearing that we need to go over, and a few more fiery exchanges between the attorneys that have everyone talking. First, let's talk about some of the impact that Karen's interviews have had on this trial. One of those impacts is the defense counsel being added to the Commonwealth's witness list. While the hearing on March 20th is in session, word breaks that there's an update to the Commonwealth's witness list. Now added defense attorneys Alan Jackson, Liza Little, and David Yannetti to the witness list. There's a footnote on the list that says that it may be necessary to call them to authenticate the defendant's numerous public statements. Now, something else that's come from the interviews is Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan asking the judge for text between Karen and her attorney, David Yannetti, from January 29th through February 2nd of 2022. Now, these texts and emails have been considered attorney-client privilege, meaning the prosecution isn't allowed to see them. When a defendant's phone is seized, if there's privileged information on there, a taint team will go through the data and basically just remove anything privileged before the report is handed over to the prosecution. So Brennan says that the texts and emails between Karen and Yannetti should no longer be considered privileged. He says that Karen has waived that privilege because she talked about those texts publicly. The motion says that Massachusetts law talks about the defendant waiving privilege if they voluntarily disclose any significant part of the privileged matter. And in public interviews, Karen has discussed these conversations that she had with Yannetti that Brennan now wants access to. The first example that Brennan gives is an interview with Gretchen Voss, where Voss asked Karen if she said, "Did I hit him?" The answer that Karen gave is written in the motion as follows, quote, "I said, did I hit him? And then, you know, when I talked to David..." Now, this is later. David said, "Karen, if you incapacitated him in any way, there's capability there." And I thought, all right, maybe this is what, maybe, I said to my mother, end quote. Now, she goes on to talk about things that she said to her mom and kind of gets off the topic of the David Yannetti stuff. And I think that he said capability here, but I think it's supposed to be culpability. But regardless, That's in the motion. Now, in the Vanity Fair article, Brennan says that Karen mentions a rumor that the Massachusetts State Police has said that there's a text between her and Yannetti that is a quote-unquote provable lie. And in the HBO documentary, Brennan quotes Karen as saying, quote, "And then when I hired David Yannetti, I asked him those questions the night of January 29th. Like, David, what if, I don't know, what if I ran his foot over? Or what if I clipped him in the knee and he passed out and, or went to care for himself and he threw up or passed out?" And David said, "Yeah, then you have some element of culpability. So that's how I thought about it for 3 days." End quote. So Brennan's argument here is that these are relevant admissions and he wants to use them to challenge the third-party culprit defense, or the Bowden defense, which calls into question the police investigation and not looking at other parties that could potentially be suspects. He seems to want to use these as proof that Karen thought she could have hit John in those first couple of days after the incident. Now, this isn't new information. Karen has said before in an interview that she was thinking about all the possible scenarios and was trying to piece together what could have happened. And her initial thoughts weren't that people in the house would have done something to John. She has also said before that it wasn't until more information started coming out that she realized something was really off here. And that's when she began to suspect that this was all a cover-up to protect members of the Albert family and inner circle. So while it's not new information, it is something that Brennan wants to exploit to the jury. It's also no surprise that Brennan has filed a motion to have all of the unaired footage from the documentary turned over to him. Now, this is for the new documentary that is airing on HBO. He says that the footage has the defense team preparing for trial, and it has extensive interviews with Karen and her attorneys, car rides to and from court where they discuss testimony and trial strategies, as well as discussions about the evidence and the prosecutor. Now, Brennan says that there are some statements in the documentary that are inconsistent with previous statements, including Karen saying that she saw John enter the house, though he doesn't say what statements those are contradictory to specifically. Now, I haven't found this statement, although I did find where Karen says that she saw John reach the breezeway door of the house, and she says she waited for him to come back and let her know that they were good to go in, but he didn't come back. So she called him after a few minutes and he didn't answer. So she waited a little longer and then she left, irritated that he had left her out there in the car. Now, there are a few other things that he includes in the motion. For example, he says that Karen confirms the argument with Marietta Sullivan in Aruba, the flirtatious text with Brian Higgins, and her belief that John may have been cheating on her. But to my knowledge, those aren't things that she's ever denied anyway. The texts with Higgins were in her phone data, so that's no surprise. And she even said in the voicemails that she left John that she thought he was cheating. Brennan also says in his motion that Karen quote-unquote mocked Mrs. O'Keefe's opinion that John looked like he had been hit by a car. Now, like I said, I hadn't watched the documentary, so again, I had to go find the part that he's talking about. And I did find a part where Karen is talking about being at John's with his family later in the morning after leaving the hospital. And Paul, John's brother, says that it looks like John went 5 rounds with Mike Tyson. Then she says that John's mom leaned over the kitchen island and says, "I think he looks like he got hit by a car." And she impersonates the tone, sounding accusatory when she says it. So Karen then says that she was like, "Wait a minute, were you both looking at the same body?" Now, I don't know that I see that as mocking Mrs. O'Keefe's opinion, but between that and the paragraph above that in the motion where Brennan brings up things that he says Karen admits to, that she has never before denied to my knowledge, it seems like maybe this is intentional. Because I think that a big part of Brennan's prosecution will be trying to make the jury dislike Karen. And I think a big part of his pretrial strategy is also to make the public dislike Karen. But whatever the reason, Brennan says that he wants the extra footage. He says that that will allow him to put the statements that he plans on using in context and help him prepare questions for witnesses for the upcoming trial. Now, let's shift gears for a moment to one of the rulings that I mentioned in a previous episode. The defense has asked Judge Cannone to reconsider her ruling on allowing in the opinions of the Commonwealth's dog behavioral expert, Dr. James Crosby. Now, you'll remember that I was shocked that the judge ruled that this was allowed, especially since she was so clear in a previous ruling that medical causation opinions could only come from a medical doctor. I was also shocked at how differently these two experts were handled. Because here's the thing, bottom line, each of these experts wants to testify about their opinion on whether or not the injuries from John's arm came from a dog. So we have a medical doctor with 30 years experience and published work about dog bites, and she comes in for the defense, and the judge requires a voir dire that lasts for 2 full days, where Dr. Russell's 30 years of experience and training and education and methodology are picked apart. And the defense has to prove that her testimony meets the Daubert requirements, and that her methodology is accepted, and that she's qualified to give her opinions. Now, the judge does rule that she's allowed to give those opinions, but her ruling includes pages of reasons why it was allowed, and reasons why she thinks the Commonwealth had valid arguments about why it shouldn't be. And she even said in those pages, in that ruling, that she said it was a close call, which is also something I've never once seen in a motion from a judge before. So then along comes the Commonwealth, and they want a dog behavioral expert, not a medical doctor, to give his opinions on the injuries on John's arm. And not only did she not require a hearing for this one, but she approved his testimony in one short paragraph and was basically like, yep, you meet all the requirements, even though we didn't go over any of them. In fact, Judge Cannone said in her ruling that the prosecution satisfied those foundational requirements and said that the methods are reliable, but she didn't cite anything to show what made her decide that. And Alessi points out in the motion that Brennan didn't cite anything either. In fact, Brennan basically just made a blanket statement that said Crosby engaged in substantial methodology, but he didn't give any kind of examples or explanation, or really anything that backs up his statement. He just states it as fact and the judge accepts it. Now that's a vast contrast from the defense's expert. The whole thing was just really surprising to me, and to most people following this trial closely. So it's no surprise that the defense is now asking the judge to reconsider. Now, this motion was brought up during the hearing, but Judge Cannone didn't want to address it. She says she'll wait until after Dr. Russell's testimony to make a decision on this. If Dr. Crosby is allowed to testify about this, and the judge sticks with her ruling, the defense has an expert named Garrett Wing that they intend to bring in. Wing is the founder and owner of American Standard Dog Training, DIY K9, and he is the owner and training director of American Overwatch K9 Services. He's an 18-year law enforcement veteran, commander of Tactical Investigations Unit, senior police K9 unit supervisor, and has been an instructor for a ton of police department K9 units. Now, if Crosby is allowed in, the defense will bring in Wing, who will likely give the opposite opinion based on his experience. Moving on, Brennan filed a motion asking that the manner of death on the death certificate be redacted. Now, the manner of death in John's case is undetermined, which is one of the 5 possible options. Manner is always listed as either natural, accident, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. Now, in this case, there wasn't enough evidence for the medical examiner to say that it was a homicide, which is something that Proctor wasn't happy about, if you'll remember his text from the first trial. And it's something that supports the defense's case, because it shows that there wasn't enough evidence to determine that John was hit by a car. It's not uncommon for terms like homicide, suicide, or accident to be redacted because they imply a determined liability. For example, homicide in the death certificate world simply means that one person caused the death of another. It doesn't mean that there's a criminal implication. Like if there's an intruder in your house firing a gun at you, and you fire back and hit them, the manner of death for them will be homicide. But that doesn't mean that you are criminally responsible. And that can be confusing for a jury, so those words are often redacted. But undetermined doesn't imply any type of liability, so the defense opposes this being redacted. The judge says she'll decide on this issue later. Now for some of the bigger issues and some of the bombs during the March 20th hearing. Brennan has asked that the judge not allow the defense to raise a third-party culprit defense. His argument is that there's no basis for it. He says that there's no evidence that John entered the house, and allowing a third-party culprit defense will turn into a mini-trial of other witnesses. Brennan says they can't just come in and start accusing people of murder, and he says that the defense has been unclear about who the third-party culprit is, and they can't blame everybody. But Yannetti says they aren't blaming everybody. They have it narrowed down to three.
So can you tell me the three that you say it is?
Sure. So the potential third-party culprits that we have identified are Brian Albert, Brian Higgins, and Colin Albert.
Yannetti says that he has a lengthy argument prepared with evidence regarding each of these three, and the judge says that they need to decide what they're going to give her before she makes her decision on whether or not it will be allowed in. Naming the three specific culprits set off some fireworks online and in the courtroom, so we'll see how this plays out during trial. We'll be right back after this. Speaking of fireworks in the courtroom, the last three motions from March 20th that we're going to talk about were some of the most explosive. First, let's talk about Dr. Welcher. Dr. Welcher is a biomechanical engineer that the prosecution intends on bringing in to say that he disagrees with the biomechanical engineer hired by the feds, and he thinks that the injuries to John are from Karen's SUV. Now, the defense has challenged Dr. Welcher's testimony, saying that it should be banned because there's no methodology, and he doesn't specify what studies he used to reach his conclusions. And Welcher performed an experiment to determine the cause of the injuries on John's arm that Alessi says should not be allowed in because it's considered junk science in court trials. So another big issue here is that the defense says Dr. Welcher has gone way outside the scope of what his qualifications are, and he's using witness testimony, which is contested by the defense, and an expert witness can't use testimony from witnesses in their conclusions. So for an example, if he's an expert, he should rely on expert-y stuff instead of relying on a witness who said John didn't go in the house, especially when the defense doesn't necessarily agree with that testimony. Now, Alessi gets up to argue this motion for Judge Cannone, and as he begins, she immediately cuts him off and says this to him.
In my presentation today with regard to Dr. Welcher.
No, I was just wondering if you're going to tell me what you're going to tell me and then tell me and tell me what you've told me. Do you plan on doing that, or are you just outlining it?
I do not, Your Honor.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, look, I'm not going to lie. This really rubbed me the wrong way. I understand that Judge Cannone has issues with Jackson and Yannetti, but Alessi is so respectful when he gets up to argue his motions. And he's so gracious to the judge, and I love how organized he is. He gives an outline of what he's going to address, which is not only good for the record, but also gives a chance to get whatever documents you may need ready to follow along, and then he goes through it. I would much rather have that over Brennan, who gets up there and just starts throwing out information that later turns out to be completely false. I thought this was unnecessary and rude. Not a good look. So Alessi makes his arguments. Now, a few key things that we hear during this. Welcher plans on telling the jury that he thinks the marks on John's arm are consistent with the orientation of the taillight fragments, and he will give testimony about the air temperature because he says that that can affect the taillight or how it breaks. Also, Welcher did a drop test, an experiment about the arm injuries, and an experiment to test the potential outcome of the contact of Karen's car and John's car in John's driveway. And Brennan plans on introducing these at trial. So, Alessi wants the experiments excluded and cites case law that says that for experiments to be used in trial, the conditions must be substantially similar to those at the crime scene. Alessi also brings up case law that says that testimony that is prepared solely for the purpose of trial, as opposed to testimony that is flowing naturally from an expert's line of scientific research or technical work, must be scrutinized a lot more closely by the judge. because that's the gatekeeper of what comes into the jury and what doesn't. So basically, Alessi says that this expert is going to come in and talk about these experiments that he has never done before in his field of research. And he did them solely for the purpose of this trial, which, according to the Supreme Judicial Court, is a big issue. Also, the prosecution is once again bringing in a non-medical doctor to give testimony about the causation of injuries when the judge has already previously ruled that that's not allowed. Well, at least that was the rule when it was the biomechanical engineer that the defense wanted to testify about it. So the defense is wanting to limit what this biomechanical engineer can testify to. And they point out that his presentation is like 140 pages and includes a ton of stuff that he really shouldn't be allowed to testify about. So Brennan says that they're going to pare it down, but they haven't done that yet. So the defense can't really prepare their part of trial. So if Brennan knows that a bunch of the stuff isn't going to be allowed in at trial, and he knows that he's going to keep it out anyway, then why have the defense waste time arguing it in these hearings when Brennan could have just told them what he actually is going to use, like he was supposed to? So Brennan gets up to give his arguments on this, and this is how he starts it out.
I'm particularly disappointed that Mr. or Attorney Alessi sees this as some type of trial by ambush. I'm not going to digress the way he has, but a case study in that is the ARCA, and that's why I'm concerned about waiting until the day before trial to get simple Rule 14 discovery.
This part is frustrating. Brennan gets up and once again, instead of addressing any of the issues in the motion or any of the things that he was supposed to have done and didn't, he begins with the personal attacks on the defense team. Now, this has become a pattern, and I'm sure you can all tell from previous episodes, but I'm really over it at this point. And judging by how the rest of the hearing played out, I think the defense attorneys are really over it at this point, too. Now, this continues as Brennan talks about how the production from Welcher was the most complete production he's ever seen, and how he did so much more than ARCA, and his expert is so amazing, and the defense's expert doesn't compare. This is how Brennan usually argues his motions, attacking the defense attorneys and the defense's witnesses instead of discussing the qualifications or legal basis for including his own. I highly dislike Brennan's theatrical and accusatory style, and sometimes he makes it really hard to listen to him when he gets up and begins everything with his dramatic, over-the-top nonsense. But I do think it's a fair point to allow the experiments from experts in if they meet the standards for being allowed in. So if he can show that his experts' experiments do have basis for being in, let them. If ARCA's experiments have basis for being let in, let them. But it is ironic that Brennan is arguing that the defense only wants this excluded because it's a different opinion than their experts, and that it should be a battle of the experts. And the reason that's so ironic is because Brennan has tried to have every one of their experts with a different opinion excluded from testifying. Now, one thing that we hear during Brennan's argument is that Dr. Welcher was able to download the TechStream data, and Brennan says that they have new information that shows the time and place of the car, which is something they didn't have before. Now, Brennan has no credibility left with the things he says in court, so I'll wait to see what the expert actually testifies to, but if this is true, that's great, because the more information we get and the more information the jury hears, the better chance they have of making the most informed decision. Brennan says the new information shows that John's phone was connected to the Bluetooth in Karen's car, and it disconnected at 12:30. He says the alleged collision occurred within 2 minutes after that. Now, I'll be very interested to hear more about this at trial. It's at least a 6-minute drive from 34 Fairview to John's house, and that's without snowy conditions. And Proctor testified that Karen was back at John's by 12:34, and she connected to his Wi-Fi at 12:36 and 9 seconds. So if the Commonwealth's new theory and timeline is that she hit him at 12:32, she wouldn't have made it back in 2 minutes. So that's something that they'll have to have some kind of explanation for. And I'm sure it'll be used on cross-examination with this new theory. Now, Brennan also said that they now have cell phone battery temperature information, which should also give a little more information or insight, at least about where his phone was. It's also really wild that we're now on a second trial and are still getting all new information. So Alessi gets back up on this one, and this is where things first start to kind of go off the rails. Now remember, Brennan got up and began his whole argument by insulting Alessi, and then spent his argument insulting the defense and especially ARCA. He also insulted them in his motion for this, accusing them of creating a seemingly endless echo chamber of false information. So at this point, Alessi's sick of it, and I can't blame him. He says that Brennan got up there and said that ARCA didn't have methodology in their report, but he says that's false, and there are 14 different footnotes in their reports explaining the methodology and sourcing. Alessi is mad.
The methodology is documented. I do not understand how an attorney can get up and say a report doesn't have something without having a basis for saying it on a key issue that is disputed.
Now, Alessi is usually the calmest of the attorneys, but he's big mad. And I get why. This is a big problem. If Brennan is saying it's not in ARCA's report, but it obviously is in the report, and Brennan is once again lying to the judge, this goes toward that whole candor to the court thing that Judge Cannone was saying last week to the defense. Now, Alessi also says that the statement that Brennan made about ARCA and Dr. Welcher doing the same stuff is false. He explains that ARCA was very clear that they did a force net equals mass time acceleration calculation. And they did it based on 15 miles per hour and then 24 miles per hour and determined that those injuries wouldn't occur based on those calculations. Alessi says it was a proper biomechanical engineering analysis. And that's why this is different than Dr. Welcher's experiments. They used math and physics to do calculations. They did not just use pattern recognition to look at the injuries on John's arm and then line them up with the taillight. So Brennan gets up to respond to this in a very Brennan way.
Regrettably, I note Attorney Alessi has decided to join the fray of disparagement. Now, he has said three times that I've made false statements. This isn't the first time that Mr. Alessi has tried to portray the Commonwealth as being disingenuous, because they know full well this is being covered by the media, and they want to create a sense to dehumanize anything that they don't like, whether it's the government, the prosecution, the witnesses, or the evidence. There's no place for it. Three times. This follows when he made representations, reckless representations in court, that Brennan lied 10 times.
So once again, instead of acknowledging the actual issues and talking about reports, Brennan just gets up there and says that Alessi is only attacking him because of the media. Which, by the way, Alessi seems to be the least concerned with the media of all the defense team. But Brennan can't give actual answers to any of the actual issues, so he just goes into attack mode. Every time. It's predictable. Brennan does finally say that Dr. Welcher gave some sources, but says that they aren't footnoted like ARCA, explaining which resources he used for which conclusions. But he says that they are all listed together. So the tethering together that Alessi mentions here is still an issue according to the defense, but Brennan says it's all there somewhere. Now, this is kind of like if you write a report with a bunch of sources, but don't say what information comes from what source, and you just kind of put all the sources at the end. I think Alessi is saying that there's not a way to see where everything came from and how the conclusions are supported. Now, Judge Cannone doesn't rule on this one yet, and they end up moving on to some other issues.
We'll be right back after this.
One of those issues is the out-of-court statements that Brennan wants to bring in. Okay, so the prosecution has said that they don't intend on using the whole Aruba argument during this trial, but they are still going to try to bring in some other statements that were made in hopes of providing a motive for murder to the jury. So Brennan says that he wants John's niece to testify about any issues in John and Karen's relationship, and he wants to introduce the same texts that were in the last trial. Now, he plans on introducing these to show the jury that John wanted to break up with Karen and that they had a tumultuous relationship. Jackson says that this is just an attempt to assassinate Karen's character to the jury and to try to get them to dislike her. And he points out that the videos that we see of John and Karen that night show them very affectionate and laughing together, and that every witness that was with them that night said that they were getting along and everyone was happy. Okay, so as far as them getting along and or John wanting to break up with Karen, if you look at the entire text thread from that day, John is actually the one asking Karen to come spend the weekend with him, and he's the one asking her to come to the bar to meet him. Those texts weren't read in court, but the jury had access to them, and they were able to read them during deliberations. Now, they did discuss their argument in those texts also. Karen said to John that he really hurt her this time, and they talk about how Karen spoils the kids, and it makes John mad, and John doesn't like that he always has to be the bad guy when it comes to them. The few texts that were shown in court were a very small portion of an all-day text thread, and it's not really representative of what was actually happening. So that part is actually easy to introduce to give the full picture if that's what Brennan is wanting to show. Now, between the text with Higgins when Karen and John were having issues and the arguments that they talked about in their text messages, we know that things had been rocky with the couple. That's not a surprise. One of the witnesses, Mrs. Kolakithis, testified that they weren't able to spend enough alone time together, but Karen had told her that she was excited because they had a trip planned in the future so that they could spend some alone time together. So it seemed like things had been tough, kind of off and on, but were potentially looking up. Now, as far as them fighting that night, we do know that they were lovey-dovey at the bar, kissing and hugging and all of that stuff. All the witnesses said they were getting along, all was good. But we also know that once they left, at some point, Karen got mad at John. She has said that before in interviews, and of course, we've heard her angry voicemails to him after she left Fairview Road. So here's Jackson's legal point with all of this. According to the law, what John's state of mind was is completely irrelevant unless they can show that, one, John communicated that state of mind to Karen, as in he told her that he was planning on breaking up with her. Two, she was aware of that state of mind. And three, that this was something that made her act on this by murdering him or hitting him with her car. Also, murder doesn't make a lot of sense here because they weren't married, so she wouldn't gain anything from it, no financial benefits. And she also left those angry voicemails that night. Like, she's mad and yelling and cussing at him. That's not something you do if you just murdered someone. So Brennan gets up to give his argument on this and brings up the interviews that Karen has done. On the 2020 episode, Karen is asked if she was angry with John that night, and she says yes. Then in the Gretchen Voss interview, she says that she was temporarily frustrated that night, but it wasn't an argument, and she says that she was pissed until she fell asleep. So once again, at this point, this hearing starts to go off the rails. That starts somewhere right around here. Brennan gets up, and look, this whole thing is supposed to be on the state of mind of John, right? But he says nothing about that and instead focuses on Karen's state of mind. And he brings up a totally different issue now than the one that he was originally arguing. So instead of Karen being upset that John was going to leave her, which is what he was originally arguing, now he's focusing on Karen being jealous of another woman. Again, this is where things start to derail. So I want to see if we can clear this up. Now, before we get into the heated exchange, let's take a look at some of the facts that we know because this is what they're about to debate. The night that John and Karen were on the way to Fairview after leaving the waterfall, Jen gave John these directions on the phone.
I instructed him that it was by a friend's house, his niece and my daughter's friend. And I said, it's right, go past Bella's street. It's at the bottom of the hill.
Okay, so Bella's mom's name is Ashley, and John had dated her many years before. So the next morning, when Karen is with Carrie Roberts and Jen McCabe, and they are trying to find John, there is conversation about where John could be. And Karen asks if he could be at Ashley's house.
She asked, could he have been with Ashley? And I looked at her and said, no.
Jen says that Karen is now panicking and then begins to spiral.
She was just spiraling, yelling about Ashley, who was Bella's mom, and just talking what I thought was very irrational about John maybe being with her.
So basically, Jen mentions go past Bella's house when giving directions, and nothing else is said about it at that point. And then the next morning, when they're looking for John, Karen starts asking different places that he could be. And one of those places is asking if he could be at Ashley's house because he didn't come home. And she's spiraling, thinking that he could be somewhere else. Okay, so when Brennan brings this up, this is what he says.
We heard from the testimony of Jen McCabe that when she gave directions to John O'Keefe, she mentioned a mother of a child who Mr. O'Keefe had a prior relationship with. This is minutes before we allege the collision happened. And so in the interviews that she has provided to these different outlets, she discusses the fact that she hears this information and that there was an issue or some type of interaction about the fact that he was previously dated another woman. And this is a conversation that takes place minutes before the collision.
So here's the issue with how he worded this. Nobody is denying that Jen McCabe gave directions about going past this woman's house. Karen has acknowledged this twice in other interviews. But Brennan says here that it was an issue just minutes before they got to Fairview. Listen again to how he words that part. This is important.
In the interviews that she has provided to these different outlets, she discusses the fact that she hears this information.
Okay, so far so good. Yes, Karen discusses in the interviews that Jen tells John this information, that this woman who dated John years ago lives on this road. This is true. But then Brennan continues.
And that there was an issue or some type of interaction about the fact that he was previously dated another woman.
And this is where he goes wrong and misrepresents everything yet again. Karen has never said in any interview that we know of that there was a quote-unquote issue or that there was any kind of quote-unquote interaction between she and John about him dating another woman. The conversation about him potentially being over there or any mention of him dating this woman years before was mentioned by Jen McCabe when she was talking about them going to look for John the following day. But Brennan says this interaction about him dating this woman was minutes before.
And this is a conversation that takes place minutes before the collision.
So this is a big difference, right? Having some kind of jealous issue minutes before an alleged collision is a lot different than looking for your missing boyfriend the next morning and asking if he could be over there. So Jackson's angry about this misrepresentation. And he gets up and addresses it.
Your Honor, if I could just correct the record very quickly.
Sure.
If anything Mr. Brennan just said was true, he might have an argument. My goodness. It's important to get some of the facts right. You got to get some of them right. The conversation that he just referenced with Jen McCabe was the next day. It was the next morning. Not minutes before the collision. He's read the transcript. Every time he stands up, he says, I've read the transcript. I wasn't there. I've read the transcript. We got to hold him to that burden, Your Honor. You got to get the facts right. That conversation with Jen McCabe was the next morning.
I don't blame him for being mad. This is a big deal. And there have been so many misrepresentations lately. So I get why he's angry. So Brennan does what he always does. He gets up and ignores the part that he misrepresented and only focuses on the part that he didn't misrepresent.
Before accusing somebody of getting it wrong, the person accusing should be right. I know that Mr. Jackson, Attorney Jackson, was present during the Voss interviews, but apparently they haven't listened to the interviews or read the transcripts. Page 88, line 22, not the next morning. When Jen was navigating John to the Alberts, she said it's near Ashley's house. Ashley and John had hooked up prior to John and I dating. Similarly, page 92, line 1, totally contrary to what you just heard, totally. There was a woman who was a mother to kids that were close to John's kids who lived very close to the Alberts. In fact, when Jen was navigating John to the Alberts, when I was driving, she said it near Ashley's house. Ashley and John had hooked up prior to John and I dating. She broke up briefly with her husband. Not my words.
So the insults between the attorneys continue to fly. Now, at this point, of course, Jackson wants to clarify that Brennan is only addressing that part. But what he wants to clarify is the whole thing that Brennan said about there being an issue about the woman that John dated years ago. And that was a conversation that Jen McCabe mentioned took place the next day, not that night. Jackson wants to clear the record, but the judge is ready for lunch and is sick of the attorney's mess.
We've got a lot of ground to still cover. I suggest that we take the personal attacks completely out of this. Hold on. Both sides. Let's get through these motions. Leave all the attacks, all the falsehoods, all of that. Leave it all aside. Let's focus on the motions and get through this. So I'll see everybody at 2 o'clock.
Your Honor, if I could say one more thing. As the court ponders this last issue.
I'm not even thinking about it for the next hour. Let's leave it.
So after lunch, Jackson is told by the judge that he has 30 seconds to address this. And he's able to clarify that his whole point with this is that there was no issue minutes before. That conversation was between Jen McCabe and John, not Karen. Karen wasn't involved in any discussions about that until the next day. So that brings us to the final topic of the March 20th hearing. And I know I've gone out of order from the order that they went in, but that's because some of the things that they discussed worked better grouped together in different ways. But this is the last topic we're talking about, and it was also the last big topic of the day. So tensions were still high, and this interaction became the source of 1,000 memes online. Now, the defense has a retired FBI agent named Mike Easter, who they plan on calling to testify about multiple areas, including problems with the investigation and how an investigation should be conducted. Now, this will support the defense's theory that the police didn't do their due diligence in pursuing all options. They didn't preserve evidence correctly. There was no chain of custody on, like, anything. They didn't handle the crime scene properly, etc. So Brennan wants to limit this testimony. He says basically that he doesn't know what all Mr. Easter reviewed in order to come up with his opinions. He doesn't think that it's right for an FBI agent to come in and testify about how things should have been done differently. And he thinks that the defense is going to use this witness under a Bowden defense while basically backdooring a third-party culprit defense through them. So a Bowden defense is basically saying that the police didn't pursue leads that a reasonable police investigation should have pursued. And if they had, it could have potentially led to a lot of evidence that they now will never have because they didn't bother looking. So if there's another suspect that the police should have looked at, we know they didn't, and now we'll never know what we could have found out. For example, they never searched the house or got call records for the Alberts or got a subpoena for the Ring cam footage from the Canton officer who lived across the street. So experts are supposed to come in and give their opinions on things that can assist the jury, things that jurors may not normally know. For example, a juror may not know proper procedures for evidence collection and may not understand why things are done in a certain way and what impact it can have on an investigation if they don't follow those procedures. So having someone who has testified in a ton of cases, Jackson estimates dozens, if not hundreds, about this specific thing, that could be beneficial for a juror to understand how it should have gone versus how it went. But Brennan says that this is just Monday morning quarterbacking and doesn't want it to be allowed in. Here's part of his argument.
If this person comes in and gives opinions, there'll be a slew of opinions that are shot like a shotgun approach that we'll never be able to have an opportunity to explain. Are we going to call in the Canton Police Department again and call in the state police for a second round so they can explain why they chose certain actions that Mr. Easter is criticizing? What if the Commonwealth wants to counter and bring in a state police officer to say that the investigation was fantastic, that everybody did a remarkable job under the circumstances?
So Jackson has a chance to respond, and this is what he says.
I gently disagree with Mr. Brennan. He indicates that we want to use an expert to bolster our argument. There's another word for that, or another phrase for that. It's called presenting a defense for someone charged with murder. He indicates, well, what are we going to do? This guy's going to get up there and testify. What am I supposed to do? Call a bunch of other Canton PD officers to talk about how great their investigative techniques were? Yeah, there's another word for that. It's called rebuttal. That's what you're supposed to do. And then he says, well,
you wouldn't be objecting if they called somebody in rebuttal to reinforce a great investigation?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Mr. Brennan said, what if I called a Massachusetts state police officer to say that this was the best investigation ever? I have two words. Do it. Do it. I'd love that. I'll put Mike Easter up against any expert they want to call. But the reality is, Your Honor, we're entitled to present a defense.
That part. Alan Jackson would love nothing more than the opportunity to have someone on the stand that he can cross-examine who is up there saying that solo cups and Stop and Shop bags are incredible investigative techniques, and that notes from the chief of police with LOL, no tampering, are typical procedure, and that video being turned over years later is no biggie. That would be Jackson's dream. So the judge basically tells him that she wants case law on this being allowed, and she'll make a ruling at a later time. These last few hearings have been packed full of information and arguments, and a lot of passion from the attorneys. Tons of drama thrown in during these last few weeks, and it's not quite over yet. Karen and her attorneys will be back in court on Tuesday, March 25th, and jury selection is set to begin only 1 week later. Be on the lookout for a bonus episode later this week to cover the final motions from Tuesday's hearing. And next week, I'll have an update on jury selection and a brief recap of the road to trial number 2 for those who are just joining the circus after all the recent publicity. There's still a lot to cover from Canton, Massachusetts.
My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.